on that plate cap, very soon after that plate cap. I think the ohms are going to tell him that one of those chokes is improperly wired right now and needs a repair. That's the only simple explanation I can think of for that extra 50 volts of drop. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the tech net. You got it, John.
2, meter, transmit.
HWW.
KC2WGB, I believe there's somebody in there, Dick.
Yeah, Howie, you've got some information for us. Go ahead, Howie.
I just want to say hello to Eric and just say that, boy, those LED bulbs cause a lot of problems on 6 meters. I got a 6 meter repeater on here right now on 5347, 5247, and I got to tell you, with the noise floor, it's just impossible these days to really get usable coverage. You got to run high power bulbs into the system, even though you got a hot front end. Over to you, Dick.
Eric, you've told us that you think some of these light-emitting diode systems are very noisy. Is that because of a highly spiky, high-frequency inverter of kind of yucky design? Is that what's doing it? The light-emitting diode itself, I can't believe it's making RF noise. I think it's the power supply that's feeding it, the constant current supply inverter. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
As K2RIW would say, give that man a cigar. Yeah, no, the LEDs don't make any noise. Actually, take a scope probe and put it nearby and be amazed at the waveforms that you will see. And the shape of them, from spiky to square, and you don't even have to hook your probe up to anything, and you will see it. I have some. I did some experiments. I actually was importing some replacement lamps for high-pressure sodium lamps using a bayonet-based type of device which has a power supply in it and the LEDs that sit in place of the HPS and use like a zillion of the power. So, and I also had to test some commercial lights that you actually see on the poles these days. And, you know, I'm surprised that they even passed the PLEC 15 requirements, which they don't.
Dick.
Yeah, it turns out that Andy, that is me to ALW, had some very nice, efficient light-emitting diodes in his work area of his basement, and they were making all kinds of HF noise that was giving him a lot of grief. And he had to remove that brand name and go to another brand name. Sounds like you've run into quite a bit of that on your 6 meter repeater, Howie. WB2HWW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Much. I walk around the city with a 6 meter handheld. Okay, I'm trying to go back to the 60s. Hi. And anytime I go near a traffic light, I lose the signal. I lose the signal. I lose a full quieter signal. I can take a full quieter signal, make it almost unreadable, and I can hear it pulsing. When the light comes on, obviously it's not coming from the LED, it's coming from the power supply. But I can tell you that when I walk near the pole, I can't hear anything on 6 meters.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Well, you may remind you, Howie, that the city of New York started changing the LEDs about 2 years ago.
Well, there's some of them. I got to tell you that all I know is this. I'm running 100 watts out of a good location in the city, and I can tell you, when some of the lights come on, the fluorescent lights or whatever they're using, the LED lights, I tell you what, I go from a full quiet signal to a noisy signal, Eric. And Dick, by the way, I got a 6 meter system tied in. With the UHF, 5347, 5247, for anybody. Hopefully we'll get some E-skip this season and hear some DX. So I put up a 6 meter repeater in the last couple of months. Go ahead, Dick.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Ready for line check. Quiet, they get noisier and noisier, and I'll bet you anything that's what you're hearing.
Yeah, none of us have been waiting for the beep. Let's see if we've, okay, we haven't timed out the eastern repeater. It's still operating. There are a number of traffic lights when I drive under the repeater I'm listening to on either 450 or 2 meters. We'll fade out with all kinds of local noise. Also, I've noticed, Eric, that a few automobiles have light-emitting diode tail lights that are running at some kind of a, I'm going to call it an ultrasonic frequency. As I wave my eyes, I see a stroboscopic effect. You may know that there's a proposal by which the light-emitting diodes that eventually will be our headlights and the lighting diodes that will be our taillights can be at various flashing frequencies that the eye will not see, can be doing all kinds of communicating from automobile to automobile, closing rates and braking distances and automatic driving and whatever. So there's a number of proposals by which automobiles will be talking to each other by flashing the lights at a rate that the human eye will not see. KE2EJ, I bet you know something about that, Eric. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KE2RIW, KE2EJ. There's been quite a number of audibles in the same page, like desktop engineering, electronic engineering, a bunch of them. Currently, the type being manufacturers have LED headlights. I can't stand them. Of a frequency which is quite annoying to your eye as they come. You'll notice they seem to, they make you feel as though they have their bright side, but the lights are 64,000, 6,400 degrees Kelvin, as opposed to the affiliated tungsten filaments, which run around anywhere between 2,800 and 3,000 degrees. It kind of hurts your eyes. It's something that, there's a number of studies done. Let me just raise it up for a second. There are a number of studies done in the beginning when LEDs first came around, as to what the best color temperature, what gives you the most visibility. So if you compare an LED light to a high pressure sodium light, the spread, the coverage per area, how the light reflects the color temperature of the light, how the human eye perceives it is quite different, where the LEDs are usually a single line of spectrum, and they actually have to, in the high power LEDs, don't forget what you're doing, you've really got an ultraviolet LED that's fighting a phosphor, and the formulation for the phosphor is where they get the color temperature from. And they tend to have a very narrow band spectrum, and the eyeballs don't really like it.
Yeah, there's a lot more going on here, and you've got to be very careful how you do this test. There are people who have not three sets of cones, but four sets of cones in their eye, genetically created. Red, green, blue, and yellow. There are some people who literally have some yellow cones. Therefore, they see colors slightly differently with higher acutance, higher resolution, higher color fidelity, whatever. So therefore, when you go from a broad spectrum incandescent bulb, a hot filament, which has got a very broad continuous spectrum of emission, and now you go to these very narrow line light emitting diode and laser like things, some eyes respond to that okay. Some human eyes, that these are people who are not colorblind, but the differences in the way we perceive color vision from one set of eyes to another are such that I'll bet you more accidents could take place because the real resolution under tough conditions, like a wet road and a snowy night, I'll bet you there's certain disadvantages that if they do a thorough enough test, they can find that out. And a corresponding, let me drop it. So I wonder if any of your trade journals are starting to address that phenomena, Eric, and is there a way that a slightly broader spectrum, lower, instead of 6,400 Kelvin, can they bring it down to something a little bit more pleasant? 6,400 Kelvin is a bluish-white, rather harsh kind of lighting, and I'm not sure that the human eye responds with a full acutance that that in place? Have they come up with phosphors that can put out a more broad, lower frequency spectrum that would be more pleasing to the eye and higher in visual resolution? KE2EJ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2LIW, K2EJ. The reason why it was chosen at between 6,000 and 6,400 degrees, there are a number of studies done in terms of the acuity of vision. It was done by a number of universities, by the physiological psychological department, in terms of where do you get the best ability to see something the farthest away with detail. It's sort of like, well, you consider this particular color type of yours is not quite the top of what God's light, but don't forget God's light's got a lot of other stuff with it, that it is, in essence, accentuating the edges because of the way it lights up both of our cones in this case. Because you're talking about an environment that is basically dark, and you're making an area of light that is contrasted with dark. So, and this is quote-unquote the result of what's best according to the study. So, as far as the manufacturers are concerned, you know, that argument is over with, and to revisit it economically is going to make some people crazy. But, as far as making formulations for different color temperatures, that's easy. Don't forget, we make red LEDs at different wavelengths. We make green LEDs at different wavelengths. We make blue LEDs at different wavelengths. It's not as narrow a spectrum as in these component LEDs that we make, whereas the ones that are 6400 degrees. So we got, there's a white, quote unquote white component to it, so there are the other frequencies there, but not really.
There's a lot more here than first meets the eye, pun intended, Eric. Without a doubt, a dark adapted eye can see 10 dB more or 20 dB more sensitivity using the dark adapted rods as opposed to the cones. That's the good news. However, the high Accutane, the high resolution area of the eye, the macula in the center of your retina, and the center of the macula is your fovea, where you've got a very high concentration of cones. You're reading a fine print with those cones. A dark adapted eye, the rods are much more sensitive, but the rods have a much wider spacing. To my knowledge, you cannot read a book with your rods. You can only read print with your cones. So even though 6400 Kelvin light emitting diodes will give you greater sensitivity at long range, a dim target, you can tell something is there. You will not be resolving it.
Remember I said edge? Specifically edge. We're talking about not any kind of resolution.
Okay. If I can't resolve, if I can see a target out there and say, yes, there is something there, I hope it's not a human being, I hope I'm not going to run over it. But if I can't resolve what it is, I still got a lot of ambiguity as that target gets closer to me when I'm driving down that road. So just being able to tell something is there, to have sensitivity to detect, is only half of the problem. You've got to resolve that target to know that you're steering around it and to know it's not a human being. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2LIW, K2EJ. You're absolutely right. To make an edge, what essentially you could do is just take an image, okay, and invert it and lay it on top of it. And the information that you get will just be what the outline is. So, the study was done based on street lighting, not headlights into blackness. So there's a specified distance between the lamp and the ground and the amount of coverage, area coverage, and what you're seeing it from afar and seeing it from close. This is where they come up with this stuff. The car manufacturers basically took that and applied it to their operation, which is lighting up the street.
the flex in the moving vehicle. And if you'll notice that the vehicles that have the LED lights, they essentially have lenses in front of them to give them the gravitation. They could, in fact, make a mixture of phosphor that is more broad spectrum, that is a little bit lower in overall color temperature, and still be able to do all the things that they want to do at high speed rates of light itself.
WB2HWW with a comment on this?
Yeah, we'll get to you in a second, Howie. Let me get beeps. There's another big variable here, Howie. I mean, Eric. If I'm studying a street light at 6400 Kelvin, illuminating a scene, and now the scene is being illuminated at one angle, the reflection off that scene is coming back to my eye at another angle, and I want to be able to resolve, detect, and resolve. That's one condition. However, if it's my own headlights illuminating that scene, and I'm getting reflections back from micromedias, from the hydromedias, and the snow and whatever, now that's a horse of a different color. You take your laser pointer, and you point it at normal sky, with a little bit of moisture in that sky, and you line up your eye parallel to that laser pointer, and you look at those reflections over those dots out there. You get an entirely different picture as opposed to holding the laser pointer at arm's length away from you off to the right-hand side, and you're aiming it forward, and now you see a very different scene. So the reflection you get from snowflakes, we'll say, from your own headlights, versus the reflection you get from snowflakes from a streetlight, very, very different. As such, 6400 headlights, I think there could be some strong disadvantages there that are not being detected as opposed to 6400 streetlights. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2LIW, K2EJ. I agree with you. But there's a couple of things here that you've got to take into consideration. Number one, LED lighting is not coherent. So, you know, we can leave the laser argument in terms of, but let's be conscious of the fact that when you point the laser beam, if it's perfectly clear air and there's not a speck of moisture or dust in it, you'll never see the beam. As opposed to, you know, having particles that are available to reflect that light. It happens, in this case, to be coherent. The fact that it's being reflected back to you in an incoherent fashion, because the particles don't line up exactly the same, and angle of reflection is slightly different from each one. So let's throw that out and around the window, we think. Okay. I don't know if you've ever been to a movie set where they shoot outside, right? They bring these lights that have these big huge ballasts called HMIs. They're halide mercury ionization lamps. They're literally arc lamps. They produce a very broad spectrum. They're very bright, and they're very blue. And they freaking hurt to look at. Their color temperature is up in the 63 to 6700 degrees. But it's absolutely perfect when you get that reflected light back from the subject when you're recording it in film, or you're putting it into a sensor and turning it into an electronic signal. There is definitely a good reason to use it optically in terms of what happens, but you're not putting the human equation in that in terms of feeling, because generally when we do that, we're making the measurements with some artificial device, not an eyeball.
Is the HMI light essentially an arc light that's putting out a fairly broad spectrum, as opposed to laser-like light, which is a very narrow line coming out? Over to you, Eric.
Very much so, but I'm trying to get you to disassociate LED lighting from laser lighting, because they're two different animals.
Okay, you're telling me then that a real laser pointer is considerably more narrow than a light-emitting diode, ultraviolet output for high efficiency, phosphor inside, bringing it down to optical frequencies. And I think you're saying that although it's a single line, it's not a coherent single line.
Bingo.
Okay, therefore you're telling me the specular backscatter, the character characteristic of backscatter, which is very angular sensitive. I think you're telling me that light-emitting diodes are less sensitive to that phenomenon.
Let me qualify for you. The qualification here is high-power LED light, not the little chip that glows that you see inside a little bubble of plastic. We're talking about these LEDs that are in a sort of like a round case, and when you look at them, they kind of look yellow. That yellow is a phosphor, which behind it is an actual LED, which excites that phosphor. So you get a rather interesting pattern out of them that is kind of random based upon the granularity of the phosphor itself. Think about the light that comes off of the CRT. It's the same game.
Okay, the light-emitting diode that I use as a illuminator to a instrument panel, the little brown, little round blob of plastic with a light-emitting diode in there. How coherent is the light coming out of that thing, Eric?
It's not a laser, okay? It's not bouncing things back and forth and lining them up, but it is way more coherent than, say, let's say, a filament LiPo.
Yeah, the real lacing tube that you've got with a... Hold on now. If it was a helium neon laser tube, you've got a real tube with mirrors on each end. That's an extremely high-Q structure. Therefore, very coherent light comes out of that.
We can do that in a slab of silicon, too, you know.
That was my next question. My laser diode pointer, are you telling me there really is a pair of mirrors in there, that it also is an extremely high-Q structure, that if I had the ability to look at it with an optical spectrum analyzer, it would be an extremely narrow, major line? Is that what I would see, Eric? Would the line width be almost identical to that helium neon thing? Go ahead.
That is correct. Within a certain limit, where you would be able to get a better, let's call it a better form spot in terms of how the coherent light is lined up next to each other, how each photon sits next to each other. Whereas you might not be able to get as nice a spot out of the slab of silicon, but you'll still be getting coherent light out of it. It may not just be lined up in a perfect circle.
My green laser pointer really is not running at green. I think they're predicting they'll eventually have green lasers. But right now it's running at an infrared frequency. It goes into a fancy crystal that does frequency doubling. So it comes out at 500 and some odd nanometers. It's really being fed at 1,000 and some odd nanometers. And so I'm guessing that that frequency doubling operation maintains the narrow, coherent, narrow line spectrum. Is that true?
Yes, it does. And that's how you make the color.
So right now, the only pure laser pointers are red, and almost all the other colors are really going into an infrared light-emitting, infrared laser diode going into some kind of a fancy crystal frequency doubler. I'd love to know what is the efficiency of that doubler. And I have reason to believe that a green laser pointer is putting out simultaneous 550 nanometer green simultaneous with some of the feed-through of the 1,000-something nanometer infrared. I think the infrared is also present. It might even be almost equal in strength. What do you think, Eric? K2LAW?
No. It is a lot easier in terms of at a molecular level or an electrical deposition level to work with longer wavelengths. It's easier. I'm trying to remember. I remember reading about the structure of a couple of the things that they were doing. It's not coming to my mind. You know what? Let's bring this up another time because it's interesting enough that I'm going to dig into this a little bit deeper, and then I think we can have a better discussion about it. But in reality, in terms of like when I'm doing a laser show or something like that, you know, I'm using eyes on lasers, which is great, and it's a very nice narrow spectrum, but it blends well. That's a whole other thing. P2IWK2K.
Okay, I'm going to give you one more piece of information. The evidence that I have that I think the infrared is coming out of there with pretty strong amplitude is that when I aim my green laser pointer at certain kinds of post-its, some of these post-it things are made with phosphorescent colors. In other words, they've got a so-called a day glow bright color to them. I aim my green laser at one of those red posters, and what comes back is orange. In other words, some other crazy color comes out of the phosphorescence of that post-it tag. I'm aiming green at it, and I do not get green back. I think the phosphorescence is being illuminated by the infrared and emitting some other crazy frequency.
Yeah, you're getting absorption.
I'm getting more than absorption. I'm getting some kind of excitation and reflection of a crazy color, which is not what my eye sees. I think the infrared coming out is lighting up the phosphor of that post-it tag in a funny way. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what high-power LEDs do with their phosphor. Although the light's being reflected back at you, it's not necessarily coherent anymore. It's the nature of the way the phosphor sits on the paper, the shape of the paper, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, I do notice that any reflection I get of green has that that speculation to it. It looks like a whole bunch of speckles. And by the way, those speckles behave in a peculiar way. The peculiar way is that when I'm wearing my corrective lenses, I see one frequency of dots. I take off my corrective lenses, I'm looking at a scene that is a complete blur to my eye, and yet the reflection I got has got these sharp little speckles to it. How the hell are those speckles being properly focused when my eye is not focusing on that scene, but I'm looking at the reflection of the laser pointer from that scene? Ain't that crazy? Over to you, Eric.
Well, I mean, if you consider laser light, if you do it diagrammatically through a slice of the eyeball passing through the lens, and the way it excites the cones themselves, there's a lot of interesting things, because what's happening, you're having interferometry occur right inside your eyeball.
That's probably the explanation. I do know that when I'm looking at that speckled diagram reflection, I see a very different pattern of speckles with my corrective lenses and without my corrective lenses. Let's see what Howie had to say about all of the above. WB2HWW, K2RIW, go ahead, Howie.
Okay. Actually, my comment was a while back. You talk about these LEDs in cars pulsating at a high frequency. I wonder how that's going to affect people with autism or anybody that's going to have seizures. Some people do not like lights that flicker. You know, they get headaches. I wonder how that is. And by the way, Dick, just for your information, and Eric, I'm actually on 6 meters. I'm cross-linking from 6 into 2 meters. So, over to you, Dick. I'm wondering what you think about that. I wonder how many people are going to have accidents or have headaches because the brain doesn't like the modulation.
That'll be a perceivable from the system.
Yeah, I'm hearing you beautiful on the input at 2.5, when you're on 2.585, Howie. The rate at which they're going to be pulsating these lights are either ultrasonic or RF rates. And obvious by the fact that when you and I watch a movie at 32 frames per second, we'll say, 32 frames per second. The human eye, most of the time,
is 24.
Okay, 24 frames per second, but how fast is it really flashing at you?
48.
There you go. So, the human eye does not see flicker, although if you wave your hand in front of it, you'll see a stroboscopic effect. If the frequency of the light is high enough that you cannot perceive the individual pulses, and I don't think you're going to get the effect that you're worrying about, Howie. I think it takes much lower frequencies. The communication that they're going to be doing with light-emitting diodes.
Repeater, time out.
The frequencies that they're going to be using, Howie, are either going to be high ultrasonic or RF frequencies. So I don't think that's going to create a human problem. Somebody want to make a comment? Who was that? K2LAW?
By the way, 10 cycles per second, 12 cycles per second, that's where epilepsy is, you know, the mother disease is at the trigger.
Okay, somebody is giving us very low audio and speaking fast. I heard something like SET. Please give us a full set of calls, and I think you want to make a statement. Go right ahead and give us a name. I heard something like zero SET, how copy. Extremely low audio. On top of that, by whatever means you're coming in, the first few seconds is being cut out. So you've got to key the mic, wait a couple of seconds, then give us your message, and give us the message slowly with a lot more audio. Over to you, sir, K2LAW.
Hello, SET is coming on one of my inputs. Dick, yeah, that's what I'm worried about, people with autism and all this new type of lighting, how that's going to affect people.
As long as it's not at these low frequencies that are known to affect them, at like the alpha rate, I don't think that's going to be a problem, but still be doing testing on that.
One comment, I have no idea what this stuff looks like. Obviously, you know what kind of situation I'm dealing with, but it's a new brave world.
To the beep, guys.
Okay, John, did we finish that particular question? And yeah, I think you would like to go on to the next one. KC2WGB, back to the mailbag. Boy, are we going on sidelines tonight? But it's interesting stuff. K2LAW, you've got it, John.
Okay, just want to make sure everything resets. Very good, Dick. By the way, I got information through the chat room. The reset function for your 811 is turn the power off, hold the AB button in, turn the power back on while you're holding the AB button in, then release it. That should set you into a reset.
Okay, darn good information. I might not have tried that particular operation, and hopefully it'll get me out of this beep 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 beep, and nothing will get it out of that. But we'll soon find out. Thank you, John. And why don't you go on to the next mailbag item if you think we've covered the previous one sufficiently. You got it, John. K2LAW.
Yes, Dick, the only thing I want to add, he did not tell me the manufacturer of the amplifier he's working with, but if it's like a Henry, like the 2K, those two tubes are in parallel for sure, and the plate circuits go to the same point of voltage origin. So the reason, and they run at around 3800, so I think he could switch those plate caps. I don't think he'll have any problem with that at all. All right. I'll let it drop, and I'll go on at least one more. Then we got to get over to Paul because he's going to be cut short. Let me let it drop.
Yeah, I've held the AB and turned it on and off a few times. That did not get it out of the mode, but it was worth a try. Thank you. Over to you, John.
Okay, on to another adventure in life. Okay, got a question on waveguide. Right up your alley, Dick. Let me let it drop. Gentleman is questioning arcing in a waveguide. Now, he understands that the arcing may only happen at the transmitting element, the little loop that's in there that actually puts that pulse into the waveguide. But does the arcing happen anywhere else down the line in the waveguard, like where there may be a flange connection or anything like that, or does it only happen at the transmitting element? Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Most coaxial waveguides to coax adapters have got a very small diameter probe, which really is a quarter wave ground plane antenna inside the waveguide. And it's a specific distance away from a short-circuited wall, and it gives you a good impedance match. When you're building very high-power equipment, that probe is no longer a skinny piece of wire. It's a great big, it's a pyramid-shaped mountain. It's a round mound, it's a device that's extremely wide at the base, a little more narrow at the tip, and when you build that kind of a device correctly, and there's kinds of launchers, there's a zillion ways of launching between coax and waveguide, and some of them are a rod-like structure that goes all the way across the waveguide and rams into the opposite wall. They do not arc over. So there's ways of building a high-power launcher that will not arc. As such, can you get arcing in the waveguide, down the waveguide? Absolutely. I have experienced arcing in a straight, super smooth, silver-plated, shiny piece of waveguide. I've experienced arcing. You go to a high enough power, every piece of waveguide will arc over. The next question is, where does the arcing occur? Let me drop it. In the case of rectangular waveguide, that signal is going down the waveguide by zigzagging back and forth, bouncing off the narrow walls. If you've got the piece of waveguide laying flat on the desk, with the broad wall parallel to the desk, the wave is going down there zigzagging left and right, and so the high current points of the short circuits, the vertical small length walls, the vertical walls, is where the high current point, that's where the bounce is taking place. The high voltage is in the middle of the waveguide, between the upper flat wall and the lower flat wall, in the middle of those walls is where you're going to get arcing. And I've seen that arcing, particularly if there's any foreign particles in a waveguide. There was a situation I ran into where, because of the silver plating that was being used on the screws that were holding the waveguide flanges together, let me drop. Somebody had made a mistake of silver plating everything on the waveguide, which included the blind fastener holes on the flanges and the screws themselves. Therefore, when you inserted the screws and removed the screws, if you looked with a microscope, you were making tiny little helical pieces of silver plating material, which was being dropped into the waveguide. And I can remember one time of occasionally getting crazy arcs in the waveguide. I suspected those particles that you could barely, it was very difficult to see them. This was S-band waveguide. It was that waveguide operating at around 2.8 gigs. The waveguide was around 3 or 3.5 inches wide, 1.5 inches high, was the rectangular waveguide.
Where was the power level, Dick?
I think it was in the vicinity of 3 kilowatts. I'm not sure. In the vicinity of 3 kilowatts. And what I did to excite the problem is that we set up the waveguide. Not only was it running 3 kilowatts, but it was running into a fairly high standing wave ratio load. So you had forward power and reflected power, which means you had additional voltage hotspots in the waveguide. I came along when the thing was running, and I had in my hand a wooden-handled screwdriver, and I tapped the wooden handle against the waveguide. As soon as I did that, it arced over immediately. What I had actually done is I had excited some of those little curlicues that were laying in the waveguide. Some of them jumped off of the bottom surface and created an arc. And once the arc was initiated, nothing in the world will extinguish that arc other than an extremely high velocity ultrasonic, beyond the speed of light, beyond the speed of sound blast of air could blow out the arc, or you must extinguish the RF energy. If not, that arc is making extremely high temperature. It really is a plasma. It'll slowly melt its way back all the way to the source of the signal. And if it was a traveling wave tube, for instance, it eventually will arc its way back, in the case of coaxial cable, right to the to the glass window, which is maintaining the vacuum on that output probe of the traveling wave tube. It will eventually arc through that, break the vacuum, and then the tube goes off the air. So you get an arc in a high-power microwave transmitter, and you think you're going to extinguish it by putting guard pieces of steel around the coax cable or whatever, you're wasting your time. That arc will proceed inside, and until you extinguish that RF, it'll slowly melt its way back all the way to the traveling wave tube, and it will destroy the traveling wave tube. So an arc at microwave...
Repeater, time out.
As I was starting to say, an arc at high power microwave frequencies is a really wicked problem. By the way, somebody has changed the audio gain to the 975-375 repeater tonight, Eric. My goodness, is that loud. And maybe that's what some of what I was hearing earlier when I was telling people that they were giving us too much audio. So an arc in a waveguide, what they do to detect it, in some cases the arc presents itself as an extremely good, let me call it 50 ohm load. You try looking for reflected power from the arc. In some cases, there won't be very much reflected power. They literally put a photo detector in the waveguide. A hell of a lot of light is being given off from that arc, and when that photo detector says, aha, I see an arc, then you better kill the transmitter real fast, because if you don't, it's going to slowly eat up everything you've got. KC2WGB, KQRIW, go ahead, John.
Okay, very good, Dick. Yep, that answers that question. I didn't know if it was possible to happen at during the length of the waveguide. I thought it would be more the transmitting element, the little antenna, the quarter wave piece that you were mentioning. I thought that's where it always happened, but okay, in the waveguide itself. I can understand with the metal particles in there triggering it. That's good stuff. All right, I just have one more quick one before we can get over to Paul, which came in on the Echo Link, and this is a question about an antenna. Just let me let it drop. Okay, this gentleman is asking, he has a mag mount which has four magnets on it. It's a good sturdy mag mount, and there's no information about what frequency he's working on or anything else. All he's telling me is his reflection coefficient, the SWR, is all over the place. It wanders like crazy, and he can't find the problem. Maybe you can give him a few tips on where to basically start out, what to check, and how he should get to a resolution on that. That seems to be a mystery totally to him. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
If his transmitter is putting out one frequency, and if the antenna isn't a whip that's being blown back and forth with a 80-mile-an-hour wind, I can't see how the real standing wave ratio would wander. If I key the transmitter and I'm looking at reflected power, or I'm looking at display of standing wave ratio, although it may be bad, although it may be high, it should be a steady reading. If it's a non-steady reading, one of two things is happening. Something peculiar is happening in the transmitter where it's not putting out a steady frequency, steady amplitude signal. That's question number one. Question number two, the standing wave ratio indicator could be faulty. I'll show you how I ran into that problem. Let me drop it. I own a standing wave ratio indicator that was made for the citizen's band. It was rated for 27 megacycles, period. It did a good job at 27 megacycles. I knew its accuracy would be bad, but it would at least be a relative standing wave ratio indicator if I used it at 2 meters or at 432. I'm not sure which one it was the problem, but I know that when I used it at either 2 meters or 432 at relatively high power, 50 watts, the particular diode in there, which was a medium good diode at 27 megs, was really a low efficiency diode at the higher frequency. What was happening is that the diode was experiencing RF heating. When the diode temperature went to a certain temperature, it stopped being a diode. It became a short circuit. So I would watch the standing wave ratio. I would key the transmitter. Standing wave ratio would be a fairly high number, and all of a sudden it would jump down to zero and sit there for a while and then jump back up. After a whole lot of investigation, let me drop. After a whole lot of investigation, I found out that the diode was being RF heated, went into a short circuit mode. As such, all indication and rectification went to zero. The needle dropped down to the bottom. As the diode acted as a short circuit, it no longer was absorbing any RF energy, and therefore it was reflecting it all, so to speak. It cooled off, and then it would jump back into normal operation, and the needle would jump up again. So the heating of the diode in my standing wave ratio indicator was making my apparent visor jump all over the place. But other than that, any reasonable antenna cannot have standing wave ratio that changes versus time. A reasonable transmitter should put out one frequency at one amplitude. And so one of those things is changing if his visor is all over the place. Step by step, by trying some other transmitter, by trying some other standing wave ratio indicator, trying some other antenna, he'll eventually isolate what's going on. He's going to have to divide and conquer. There's a lot of possible explanations for this one, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Good point you brought up, Dick. Yes, okay, so he can start that. Maybe next week he'll drop in with more questions if he has it. All right, that's it from the mailbag, and thank you for the answers. And over to Paul. Let's see what exciting news he has for us. KC2WGB.
You got it, Paul. And hopefully Paul's going to come into the 2585 because the 975-375 input does have some unusual audio sound tonight. It was beautifully balanced a week ago. Something has happened since then. WS2N, K2RIW. What's NASA doing that's going to blow our mind this week, Paul? You got it, Paul.
Okay, this is WS2N, and I'm coming through Glen Oaks, so how am I doing anyway? Before I keep continue, Dick.
You sound beautiful. Please proceed.
Oh, okay, very good. We talked about that landing on the barge a week or two ago. It was the beginning of May, and that's the one where they had a very fast speed for the booster to come back. This is SpaceX that I'm talking about, bringing the Falcon 9 booster back to the drone ship, and it looks like they're not going to be able to reuse that booster. They plan on using the previous booster that they used for the one that they used for the International Space Station, for the cargo mission, and for the beam mission when they attached the inflatable module to the space station. That one they'll probably reuse, but the one that came back, I remember we discussed the high temperatures that would be involved because this was coming back at roughly twice the speed instead of, let's say, 4,000 miles an hour, almost 7,000 miles per hour, but the heating of the booster was going to be increased, four times. And it turns out there is some damage to that, so they don't plan on using it, but it's an educational boost that they'll be able to do better in the future by checking out what the problems that they had. I mean, they did get back safely, drop it, and land right dead center of the drone ship, the autonomous spaceport drone ship, they call it. So I just want to report on that. You know, we talked about it. Sure enough, there was damage. So that's been confirmed by Elon Musk. I thought that would be interesting. Now, they do have another flight coming up in a couple of days. And that's going to be launching DIACOM, our geosynchronous flight. And that will be going up on Thursday of this week. We'll see how they do with that, but that's going to be another geosynchronous orbit. So that, again, high-speed booster. And they will attempt to bring that one back to a drone ship as well. We'll see how they do. Fuel is a big problem. The margin is not there for these flights. They use most of it up to get the second stage and first stage going fast enough where they eventually can get the satellite to 23,000 miles out. This is WS2N. So, I don't think I dropped it long enough. Stand by. Okay, I'm only hearing one beep now. Okay, so yeah, I had to bring that up. But on to future things that are going on in the world. I'll start with Russia. Russia made an announcement that they would like to try to put a man on the moon by 2029. That's what they're thinking about now. Their goals are a little different. Mars is a ways off. So they're going to start off with, they call them lunar glob landers, or lunar 25, as opposed to lunar 24. Lunar 24 was back in the 70s, where they had a sample return mission, which was successful. And now they're up to, of course, lunar 25, and so it's decades later. They plan on sending this unmanned vehicle to polar landing, probably in the first flight they got planned for 2021, then 2022, 2023, and so forth, until they eventually work their way up to possible landing in 29. So they have long-term plans. I know that was always one of the things we talked about on that, who's planning on doing this, and who's got actual plans. Well, Russia has plans. They've been kind of like holding tight on it for the last 2 or 3 years. So they're working on a development, and Lunar 25 is actually being worked on. It's hardware being developed. So now with them doing what they're doing, you have a company called Orbital ATK, which I've talked about all the time, and that's a company that launches the Antares rocket. They had the failed attempt back in October of 2014 of resupplying the space station, and since then they've gotten back on track. They've had two successful Cygnus enhanced missions, which are bigger Cygnus spacecraft that are loaded with supplies. They have a contract with NASA to bring these things up to the International Space Station. And since they weren't able to do it while their Antares rocket was being refitted, getting away from the NK-33 problem engine, and installing the new RD-191s, which will be probably, first flight will probably be in July of this year. So, but this company came out with, they were testifying at, for Congress. They always make these proposals. They plan on having the Cygnus spacecraft sent to lunar orbit. And they're similar, but I mean, they look like the same Cygnus resupply vehicles that they use for the International Space Station. They plan on blasting these things to the moon to put them in lunar orbit and eventually docking one to one another and having multiple Cygnus spacecraft, docked at the space station going around lunar orbit. This is a proposal that President Frank Hubbardston, be an astronaut, he's now president of Orbital ATK, was testifying and giving details of what their plans would launches, but not by Orbital ATK, but by the Orion spacecraft that NASA's building, and launched by the SLS system, the new space launch system. That will be the big rockets that NASA eventually plans on sending all the way to Mars. But in the meantime, they need to have some kind of mission. And Orbital ATK, they're coming up with this idea to create a mission for the SLS. Right, but right now they have two actual planned missions for the new SLS, first in 2018, which will be an unmanned flight around the moon and eventually bring it back to test the Orion spacecraft, but unmanned. And then eventually another one, probably a year or so later, actually a couple of years later, probably 2020 or so, with a manned flight. And right now the plan is very similar to the first SLS, which would be sending people around orbit around the moon and bringing them back. And there's been a problem thinking, well, here we have the SLS being built with the Orion spacecraft. We don't really have any missions. Yeah, they have one thing planned. They plan on going out and bringing an asteroid around lunar orbit. They've got these big plans like that. But Orbital ATK is trying to come up with something different. Now, not to be outdone by another company, Lockheed Martin, has another suggestion for Congress, and then I got, by the way, Orbital ATK wants to put four people on board the space station around the moon. That's their proposal. Lockheed wants to do a similar thing, except they want to send their versions of habitat modules that aren't even built yet, along with two Orion spacecraft that, ironically, Lockheed is the main contractor for building the Orion spacecraft for NASA. So they plan on sending two of these attached to two habitat modules, a large habitat module, and they plan on putting them in orbit around Mars and calling it a Mars base. And not to be outdone by Orbital, they plan on leaving six people in orbit around Mars. I find these all very far out ideas, but these are reputable companies that are suggesting these ideas. I can't imagine where they're going to get all the constant supplies. And if you look at their antenna structures, yeah, they have large antennas. But I mean, I would think you need something even much bigger than the International Space Station solar collecting system. You know, you're 1.6 AU away from the the sun, so you're going to be down, probably, well, I'm not.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
On Earth, you're going to get at Mars. I had to mention that. There's a couple other things with all these space stations we're talking about. China, also this week, finally came out with their final design of what the Tiangong 3 space station, Earth orbiting space station, is going to look like. So that information came out. Tiangong 3, they didn't even launch Tiangong 2 yet. That's the next space station, and that first module will be going up probably in September of this year, followed by a Shenzhou manned mission by China. So a lot of I don't know, pie in the sky or space station in the sky ideas, but they're out there. A couple more things, but